recent years, Unidos US has been closely following a growing trend in some states to undermine efforts to create diverse and inclusive curricula. In his victory speech following his re-election in November, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis declared war on such curricula and programming by stating that Florida is where, quote, woke culture goes to die. 1 year ago this month, he signed into law a bill that critics dubbed Don't Say Gay, because it bans Florida public school teachers from holding classroom instruction about sexual orientation or gender identity from kindergarten through third grade. And this February, he banned a new advanced placement African-American studies course and announced plans to shut down public school system programs focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion and critical race theory. Unidos US believes policy moves like these threaten to set the United States back decades by fomenting a culture of fear and reinforcing negative stereotypes about historically underserved and persecuted populations. So how can civil rights educators and advocates address these concerns in and outside the public school system? We at progressreport.co, the education blog of Unidos US, invited two Latinx Florida education leaders, University of Florida history professor Dr. Paul Ortiz and South Florida youth rights and LGBTQ advocate Ayari Aguayo, to discuss that question. The conversation was moderated by Dr. Vernon Damani Johnson, a veteran community organizer, anti-racist trainer, and now retired political science professor in Washington State. I'm Julianne Gage, an Unidos US consultant. We hope you'll find this discussion informative.
Good afternoon, y'all. My name is Ayari Aguayo, or Ayari, depending on which coast you're on. I use she for pronouns, and just super grateful to be here, but also very concerned and scared for what's happening everywhere across this country. Not just in our backyard here in Florida, even though I've only lived here for about 5 years now. I've worked on human rights-based issues all across the nation, anywhere I've lived, primarily focusing on young girls of color, especially as we intersect in gender and orientation. So race, gender, orientation, culture, socioeconomic, that's been my focus on the ground, community organizer and advocate. I do take part and I'm an active member of La Red de Mujeres de Afro-Latina y Afro-Caribeñas. So we're a network of Afro-Caribbean and Afro-Latin women that is international.
Oh, hey, so I'm Paul Ortiz, I direct the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program, and I'm a professor of history at the University of Florida. I'm currently president of the United Faculty of Florida, AFL-CIO, and do a lot of work. Right now, the union is really focusing on academic freedom. You know, we've never seen academic freedom as just something that we exercise on campuses. We have chapters in all the universities of Florida. And I'm also very active in the farm worker movement.
I'm Vernon Damani Johnson. I'm a retired professor of political science, I was formerly the director of the Ralph Monroe Institute for Civic Education at Western Washington University. I've been a community organizer and an anti-racist trainer, I guess really since the 1980s, and was on Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition and his presidential campaign in 1988 in the state of Washington. Actually, my academic work has involved the study of revolutionary movements in Africa, guerrilla movements and so forth. And so I've spent a lot of time in Southern Africa and Zimbabwe, South Africa, Mozambique. Most recently have gotten involved in the state of Washington in environmental justice issues. And I'm currently a board member of the Washington Conservation Action, which is a white environmental group that was awakened by the George Floyd murder and has really aggressively moved to have about a half of its board people of color, and is presently being led by an indigenous woman. So I'm kind of excited to be doing that work and excited to be here with you all this morning. Let me open by talking a little bit then about what's going on in Florida and have the two of you respond. Some of the moves by Governor Ron DeSantis recently have made Florida kind of ground zero in the U.S. culture wars right now. Ayari, I wonder if you could give us a brief overview of what's going down with education policy at the K-12 level in Florida.
Sure. Thank you for asking that. Thank you for leading this discussion, Dr. J, and all the work that you've done. When it comes to everything that is happening in the public education system, we're seeing it as, like you said, ground zero. We begin with children and young adults. And the way that we begin too is that it's coming at us in different cruxes at the same time, race, gender, orientation. So what we're seeing with the Stop Woke Act and the Don't Say Gay bills, both of those are coming after our young people of color, diverse gender and orientation experiences. And it isn't just happening with elementary, but it's happening all across. And what we saw too is a year ago, a couple of days ago to the spot, House Bill 1557, which is the Parental Rights to Education, also known as Don't Say Gay Bill, that is now being expanded. It was originally only primarily focused on elementary school kids to not be able to talk about gender or orientation, both for the students, for the parents, and the teachers. But we know that we're able to rely on Title IX, so federal laws and policies. That has been our friend to be able to get through and be ourselves. But what we're seeing too is that Ron DeSantis and the rest of Florida is now harping on our students to get rid of pronouns in the schools. And we're seeing that the school systems across the board are no longer allowed to have policies in place to protect their students based on race, gender, or orientation. And what that meant for many of our students who are openly or just coming out as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender, there used to be a guide on human sexuality to support students, and that is no longer the case. If those guides are seen within the school system, the school board is asked to take them down. And we saw that with Broward County Public Schools because they had one, Miami-Dade County Public Schools as well. And it's gotten to the point where myself being part of a coalition of folks who are making sure that our youth have everything that they need, these coalitions used to meet quarterly with superintendents, and that is no longer the case. We just found out this week. When we say we're in crisis, it is one of those, like, we are at pivotal moments of having to stand up for ourselves and our youth, right? Because we know that we're being impacted. And it isn't just in the school systems, it's also medical care, making sure our mental health and well-being is there. So some of my community partners, their grants got pulled from the school systems themselves, saying you cannot bring in therapists to provide free therapy for our young people, because that would be on the base of race, gender, orientation. So that has been taken away. And those are the little things that aren't so little, right? That strip away the supportive, just support for our young people and families. What we're seeing too is as teachers that are absolutely terrified, teachers of all races, colors, religions, backgrounds, they're terrified of what's happening with their books, with their curricula. They're having to take lists and inform the principals and superintendents what all that they are teaching. And I myself do wonder what all can be said and shared, right? Even to the point where there is such censorship that when I come into the classroom or to do and lead any kind of workshop, I have to be mindful of what I say and don't say. I'm not allowed to say directly gay, trans. I can talk about diverse gender and orientation experiences, right? So language has become absolutely pivotal. And we have to be so incredibly careful of it that it does become exhausting after a while, right? To say, this is who I am. And even myself being Latina of Afro-Indigenous descendancy and queer, how can I insert all of who I am on all of these identities and fronts and insert my experience, be a role model and support our young people and support those who are struggling when we're not able to talk about it. So that's just a little bit of what's going on.
Okay, and you know what? I want to give you both time to come back and talk a little bit about community responses. But first, I want Paul to talk about some of the same kind of things and what are some of the things that DeSantis has been doing at the level of higher education. And then we'll come back and talk about responses. So, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, this has been an ongoing attack by the state, you know, against African-American studies, against Latinx studies, gender studies. You know, the surface response is that, you know, we have this horrific bill, HB 999, which proposes to ban gender studies. As you know, earlier, the state of Florida has tried to ban Black studies and censored as much as they can, you know, with the goal of especially removing African-American women from the curriculum. They seem to be especially angry and spiteful about the work of people like Kimberly Crenshaw, bell hooks. I am in contact with a lot of school teachers across the state. Some of them are my former students, and they tell me that Toni Morrison books are flying off the shelves into storage rooms, you know, more quickly than you can even imagine. Toni Morrison is an author that the state of Florida feels very endangered by because of her incredibly powerful works on slavery, oppression, and struggle. And what the state is trying to do is they're trying to essentially create a situation where people do not have a history, a legacy, a tradition of struggle that they can draw upon. And part of this, we learn these traditions, as you know, through study. You know, we can learn them through our elders, through listening. But if you don't have the privilege of being in part of like growing up in a movement environment, you know, you have to read these things. And the state understands this. In our universities, we've lost a lot of outstanding Chinese faculty, a lot of outstanding African-American faculty because of the anti-Asian, anti-Black racism down here. All of this precedes Ron DeSantis, by the way. And I don't want us to get into the situation where we think, oh, this is just, if we just get, you know, get rid of Ron DeSantis somehow, then life will be rosy again. That's not the case. It's always been a struggle here. The other thing I want to mention is that even before HB 999 was proposed, Ron DeSantis's the first thing he said after the in the new year was that he's going after the unions. And the reality down here in the Deep South is that it's really the Florida Education Association and the United Faculty of Florida, which I'm a part of, we're the last line of defense. We're the only statewide organization in Florida right now that stands in between Ron DeSantis and his ultimate goals. And this is why he has moved to decertify us even before he launched this latest assault, right? Because as long as the unions still stand in Florida, we have academic freedom articles in our collective bargaining agreements. And so I teach Black studies, I teach Latinx studies. The state can say whatever it wants, but my collective bargaining agreement protects me from retaliation for doing the work that I know Ron DeSantis doesn't want me to do it, but hey, I have a collective bargaining agreement. The unfortunate thing is that outside of the education unions in the state, unions are very weak in Florida. And there are many reasons for that. But I tell everyone, you know, if you're not a member of a union, you better damn well join one pretty quickly down here. Because otherwise, you're dependent upon the goodwill of your employers and Ron DeSantis. And do you want to be dependent upon Ron DeSantis for your livelihood? I mean, that's just an open question.
No, I hear you. I want to just add quickly that what's going on in Florida is an anomaly. Since January of 2021, some 44 states have introduced bills or taken steps that would restrict teaching critical race theory or how teachers can discuss racism and sexism. This is according to Education Week. 18 states have imposed these bans and restrictions either through legislation or other avenues. The state level activity had its origins in September of 2020 via an executive order by then President Donald Trump, which banned certain types of diversity training in federal agencies. But now the communities have not been dormant in response to all this, have they, Ayari?
No, they have not. We are being more loud because of this. We are making sure that our young people have the tools and access they need to be able to fight for themselves and to be able to learn this knowledge for themselves. We're going back and learning from our ancestors like we did in this country back to 1776 through 1865, when we had to learn how to read and write ourselves, and we are equipping our young people to do the exact same thing. If you're going to ban these books, we are going to find these books. We are going to distribute them at higher numbers. So we are doing what we can. And I think this is where it's critical that activists, community organizers come out. And we've come out together to make sure that everyone has the tools that they need, the support that they need, and the structures that they need to get through this, to just get through this together.
Are we seeing the same kind of activity in the higher education world in Florida, Paul?
Yes, I mean, I'm really excited to share with you. I mean, of course, there's a lot of bad news coming out of Florida, but there's good news too. I mean, and part of that good news, to just echo what Ajar just said, was that our students are on the march, our communities are on the march. And February 23rd, there's a statewide event that was initiated by the Dream Defenders, which is a really important Black Lives Matter movement organization in Florida. Our students on high schools and colleges walked out all across the state in solidarity with Black Studies. And the name of this statewide action was Can't Ban Us. And it was really cool because in addition to the walkouts, we had teach-ins all across the state. And we actually had a 3-hour Black Studies teach-in at the campus of University of Florida, among others. And it was so exciting to see this because, I mean, I hadn't seen such a turnout for a teach-in since like the second Gulf War in 2003. I mean, at the beginning of the teach-in, there were 150 students, and this is a 3-hour teach-in. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I mean, as a historian, I was in movement heaven. There was never fewer than 75 students at the teach-in. There were a lot of staff, a lot of librarians, a lot of community members, and everyone came together to affirm the importance of an uncensored Black Studies. You can't have Black Studies without Angela Davis. You know, you can't have Black Studies without Roderick Ferguson, you know, one of the preeminent Black queer scholars in the country. You cannot have Black Studies without Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, one of the co-creators of critical race theory. And so I just was so inspired by this to see people and come together, you know, these traditions of struggle. It's scary. It's a scary time in Florida. And I think the state is depending upon fear and kind of individualizing us and making us feel that we're isolated. But, you know, activities like walkouts and teach-ins and just even getting together. I mean, the last thing I'll mention is that I'm hearing kind of anecdotal stories from comrades in different parts of the state. Banned book clubs are beginning to be organized. And so, you know, people are getting together in different parts of Florida, finding out what books have been pulled off the shelves in their local libraries. And they're doing a book club on that book. And the idea is that, you know, you can't, again, the theme is you can't ban us. And if you don't want us to read Toni Morrison's Beloved, well, we're going to go out and find a way to read that book. And we're going to share it with our younger people too. So, I mean, that's part of what is exciting about living in this moment now. It is a time of struggle.
Yeah, and I guess libraries are in most places are public agencies themselves, aren't they? So they come under this whole mandate by DeSantis.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of the, you know, and this is going back to the scary times of this. I mean, colleagues I know who are public librarians have been targeted for hate mail, death threats, and they've been facing harassment. Public school librarians already were basically very endangered in the sense that a lot of our schools in Florida don't even have librarians, or they have people who work part-time. And they get these really scary messages from their superintendents or the school board saying, you know, you have to pull these books. And in some cases, we're talking about hundreds of books have been pulled off school shelves and put into deep storage. And as a young person, I remember growing up, you know, back in the day, I grew up in a shipyard town. You know, none of us went to college. We didn't even know what that would have meant. But, you know, having access to books as a younger person and being able to choose your books without having adults tell you what to read, to me, is the most precious right you can have in any society. My senior year, you know, I was a terrible student, by the way. I mean, I don't know how I became a professor. That's kind of another story. But, you know, back in the day, I'm like a C-minus student. And I had one English professor, a white gentleman by the name of Don Bidwell, legendary in Bremerton, who made me read, who pushed me to read Richard Wright, Native Son, you know, Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man, Sylvia Plath, Bell Jar, Kurt Vonnegut, Slaughterhouse-Five. And he told us, you know, look, y'all, these are banned books. You know, your parents don't really want you to read these books. We had to go all the way to Seattle, take a ferry to go pick up and read these books. Now, my parents didn't really care what I read because they're too busy working. I don't even know if they would have even minded. But the point is that this freedom to read is one of the most precious freedoms you can possibly have. And the state of Florida, that's why they're going after libraries. That's why they're going after school districts.
No, I hear you, man. And it's a cautionary tale for all of us around the country. You covered some of the issues like the Don't Say Gay legislation. You talked about book banning and all of that. When DeSantis, I think it was when he got reelected, he made that famous statement that the state of Florida is where woke culture comes to die. And why do you think that the right is hammering away so much at this term woke? And do you think that the term is still useful for defining progressive cultural agenda? Ayari, what do you think about that?
Sure. Thank you for asking that, because I think that that's at the forefront of the conversation within liberal circles. And for us as activists, community organizers, and movement builders is to say what's happened recently that has us be attacked, and as well what's going on within our own movement, right, that we have to look at critically. One of those things is cancel culture. What I've seen from friends and from other leaders as well is defining very specifically why and what happened with cancel culture, right, that has folks be so afraid of being canceled that now there's an anti-woke movement because there is a correlation. So when it comes to wokeness, we know that that has been the term for 5 to 10 years now that folks have been using, but we're still in the processing of, we're still processing what it means to be awake ourselves. We're still doing our inner work and outer work. I don't think that that's going to be the word that continues to be used because it is being slanderized. And I do think that just like many young folks, we're going to reclaim the word too, to say this is what it actually means. But going back to cancel culture because of that correlation and because of the wave that is coming against us, I think that what we're realizing too within our own movement is recognizing what are we asking folks to be responsible for and be held accountable for. There was a famous movement leader, and I wish I could remember her name. She's faith-based, and she asked us to look at within ourselves at one of the Sister Song conferences, right, for women of color, what it meant to cancel someone versus what it is to have a problematic ally. And recognizing that distinction is key for us in our movement. It is key for us to call each other in rather than out, rather than cancel, and to really be mindful of what it means to have folks understand our full background, history, her story before going forward. So I think that that's where we are right now, is looking at ourselves critically and saying, where can we go, especially when we're being under such attack? What can we do now to come together, to mobilize, and to continue to be careful as we move on?
Paul, do you have anything to add to that?
I mean, not really anything to add, but just really to echo. In the 80s, you know, it occurs to me, you know, I remember the whole controversy over political correctness. And see, the thing is, you know, if you want to engage in a debate and you feel like you've lost the debate, or you feel like, you know, you just don't have the energy, the easiest thing to do is just to say, well, I've been canceled, or I've been, you know, the victim of political correctness. But I think that, you know, the reality is that for years, you know, school teachers in Florida, K through 12 teachers, have labored in an environment where they have got to be so cautious, you know, almost everything they say now, because you can have one student out of 30. I mean, you could have a course, you know, you could have a class of 31 students in the state of Florida, and 30 students are learning and thriving and doing well, you know, with all the challenges that public school kids have in Florida. And then it just takes one student or one parent to go right to your principal, and your career as a teacher has ended. Because in Florida, principals don't back up their teachers. And that's the environment that we live under. And to me, that's much more serious than anything called like cancel culture. I mean, I get canceled all the time in Florida, but I don't complain about it. I mean, I may put a Facebook post out. I mean, you know, one example was yesterday, I got a very heartfelt message from a National Educational Foundation. They had essentially connected me to a big school district in South Florida. And I was going to talk about kind of new trends in Latinx history in the U.S. And then I got this message saying, you know, we really apologize, Professor Ortiz. The leaders of the school district have got a hold of your the program. They're very concerned with your scholarship. And so we're going to have to connect you instead to a very large urban school district in the north. So originally, this was going to be a teacher's like workshop, like a full day where teachers would get credit for participating. They were going to read a couple of my articles. You know, I would give a couple lectures, you know, kind of a teacher training where they could augment their teaching credentials. And so unfortunately now the teachers in this South Florida county will not have that opportunity. And I'm excited to work with the teachers up north, but I kind of, you know, it's the teachers in South Florida that really could use this information as well. And this happens all the time. The colleagues I know who work with school districts were increasingly being directed out of Florida. Why don't you do a workshop in Detroit? Why don't you do a workshop in Trenton? Why don't you do a workshop in the South Bronx? Again, that's wonderful. There's no place on the world I'd rather be than the South Bronx. But we should also be in Miami-Dade. We should be in Osceola County. We should be in West Palm. And increasingly, we're being told you can't be there, you know, with this scholarship. And so, I mean, the last thing I'll say about this, I mean, so here's a tragedy. I was not long ago, I did give a lecture in a South Florida high school, a big high school. And, you know, probably 90% Latinx population. Most of the students there in the class I was speaking to or the classes identified as Cuban American. And I asked them to name famous figures from Cuban history. They could not. They couldn't name anyone. And I asked, well, you know, Antonio Maceo, Jose Manuti, Massimo Gomez, you know, they didn't know who, I mean, they vaguely knew who Jose Manuti was, but they couldn't tell me anything about him. And this is a tragedy. You know, you have school kids in Florida who are being cut off from their own histories by the state of Florida. When I asked them who Ronald Reagan was, every one of them knew who Ronald Reagan was. When I asked them who Rick Scott was, every one of them knew who Rick Scott was, and they all knew who Marco Rubio was. That's good. These are elected leaders. You should know who they are or who they were. But shouldn't you also know who Antonio Maceo was? Shouldn't you know that your people fought for freedom from the Spanish Empire for three centuries solid? Shouldn't you know that as well? See, these are the things that the state of Florida doesn't want you to know. They don't want you to know how to organize, how to fight for democracy. The myth that Ron DeSantis is trying to push, and he's been very clear about this, the myth is we were all created equal from the very beginning. Our founding fathers loved us and wanted us to be equal to them. That is a lie. That's a patent lie. And if you went to Thomas Jefferson, if you could somehow beam back into 1776, and you said, Thomas Jefferson, people like Paul Ortiz, you know, are they equal to you? He would have said, well, of course not. What are you talking about, man? Get out of my face. It's like they want us to believe that people never had a struggle in this country. They want to keep us passive. And so that's this whole campaign, I think, at the bottom is keep us passive, keep us fearful, keep us grateful to the state. Oh, thank you, Florida, for all the great things. And then I promise that I'll hide my identity just to make you happy, because my identity might make someone else uncomfortable. Oh, if I call myself Latinx, it could make another individual feel uncomfortable. So I'll just hide that identity. Oh, I'm queer or bi, I'll just hide those so you won't feel uncomfortable. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get us to retreat and really live in a kind of dystopian kind of environment where the state dominates everything.
This is because we're at opposite ends of the country. Couldn't be farther away in the lower 48 than the state of Washington and Florida. And of course, Washington has become a kind of a deep blue state, especially under Governor Jay Inslee here. Just to give you an example, last year, the governor signed into law after both houses of the legislature passed a mandate that Washington's 40 public colleges and universities would conduct training sessions and assessments for both faculty and staff around diversity, equity, and inclusion and anti-racism. He also, something very similar to that was done, well, they have an ethnic studies curriculum in the state in K-12, which is, you know, mandated by law so that, you know, public schools all over the state have to begin to put ethnic studies into the curriculum. But they also have a proviso where local school districts can opt out. And on the one hand, that sounds bad, but on the other hand, it preserves what has been an American tradition of local schools and local school districts being the best in the best position to decide what kinds of curriculum ought to be delivered in their local areas, because the other part of rural Eastern Washington is still very red, but it's only about 25% of the state's population. So, you know, those places who want to remain, if the opposite of woke and to be awake is, of course, to continue to be asleep and to be sleepwalking through this world. And I think in this America, the 21st century, you know, if enough of our kids are exposed to the kind of curriculum that people like yourselves are offering, I think they'll be better off as citizens and better prepared to deal with the challenges of the 21st century. But this is a battle that continues. I know we're probably running short on time, but I did want to talk, because I have the two of you here, about the Black-Brown dimension. Paul, you've researched and written about African-American and Latinx American history, and Ayari, you identify as both African and Latinx, and you've organized in both communities. In terms of the pursuit of racial justice, what is the connection between these two communities and these two histories? Now, Ayari, I wonder if you have some thoughts about that.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you for asking. I did want to touch up on a point real quick before I forget with the previous question where you asked about where woke folk come to die. I recently saw a sign out here, and I've seen it in different places in the country, having lived all over, but here in Florida, like, diversity equals white death. And this goes on to like this right here, where we're being attacked on multiple fronts, and where you asked why, not why, but why is it that Ron DeSantis said what he said about where woke folk come, where the woke come to die? Because then as a cis white man, you have the privilege of not having any repercussion for saying what you want or for being held responsible for those things, right? Which I think goes to continue to answer this question, which is about Black and Brown communities and the need and the intertwining of racial justice. So I used to live in Puerto Rico, and I was born and raised, I think I mentioned, on the US-Mexico border. So for me, you can't do one without the other. In order to be able to do pro-Black, pro-Brown work, you also have to do anti-racist work, and you have to understand how our stories have come together, how we as a people have been just sought out and attacked. And as Professor Ortiz was saying too, particularly Black women. So specifically, we know what has happened to Black and Brown Puerto Rican women of lower socioeconomic backgrounds. We were the ones who were sought after to be provided when it came to introducing the abortion pill and just looking at the morning after pill, right? What that did for us would just continue to move the eugenics movement. And I can't remember the name in the 1950s, and I'm blanking out on it, but I do know for a fact that even just knowing that background history in Puerto Rico and in New York meant that we lost a generation, but specifically of lower socioeconomic Black and Brown Afro-Latina women. We also know what happens when we look at our backgrounds and we look to say who is fighting and standing. We can learn from each other's justice movements. We can learn from the rhythms, and we can also learn it the way that we're being attacked, because that is happening simultaneously. Anti-Brownness, Brown versus the Board of Education, right? We see what's happening there in the same way that anti-Blackness is in the schools. And I will say that I think that that's part of what's easy for some of the movement that is happening when it comes to like the Stop Woke Act, is that for folks who are brown, but maybe lighter shade, which we see a lot of in South Florida, and I'll say across Florida, right? If you're Latin and you pass as white, it's a little bit different to learn. You don't feel as connected. And I'll say that not as a you and us versus them, but just as understanding that there is a privilege to whiteness, even within the brown communities and within the Latin communities that don't identify as brown. And for those of us who have more indigenous features, and I include myself in that, what it means then to say, well, what does it mean for my people who I can't pass this way, but I look a certain way and I'm treated this way? What are my people's facing? And I see a lot of that internalized. Internalized racism, internalized misogyny when I am doing justice and movement building work. I recently had the opportunity 2 years ago to attend a human rights movement, faith-based group and delegation in Honduras. And I saw the way that communities came together, the way that Black and Brown women said, we are acting in solidarity because we know what it means. The Indigenous fight is linked and tied to the Black fight because your oppression is my oppression. It is all rooted the same. And what to me is beautiful is the way that we in other countries can come together, learn from each other and stand with each other and also say, let's unpack this together to understand why we're not doing more of this in unity.
Oh, no, thank you. And Paul, I know I just learning about you in preparation for this conversation, I see where you've written a book about the African-American and Latinx American history. So I haven't had the opportunity yet, but I'm going to go out and buy it and read it because it sounds like it's a good read. But would you respond to this whole thing about the linkages, perhaps need to have more solidarity work between Black and Brown communities?
Well, yeah, I mean, just to echo Ajari's excellent points, I mean, you're seeing Black and Brown peoples across the entire hemisphere increasingly coming together and mobilizing. We saw this with the upsurge of the Black Lives Matter movement. When that upsurge happened, you had young Latinx organizers across not just the US, but across the entire hemisphere, mobilizing, leading marches, talking about solidarity for the families of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and talking about the need to come together. This terrifies these countries, and not just the US, it terrifies countries like Colombia, where Afro-Colombians played a key role in the recent elections. And I see it on campus here too, because our students are having these difficult discussions. You know, when you have a Black and Brown anti-racist discussion on campus now, and I'm, as an elder, I'm asked to sometimes come in and, you know, I may say a few words at the beginning, but my main role is just to listen. And so our students are saying, you know, hey, I'm the darkest skinned member of my family, or I'm the only member of my family that has kinky hair, and I've been told I need to lighten my skin. And it gets really personal very quickly. And so again, just to echo what Ajari was saying earlier, the conversations that we were having, I mean, I read about these as a movement historian, and I remember as a younger movement organizer, we had these conversations, but I think they're much more extended now and they're much more intimate. These are family matters. These aren't just one community talking to another community. The most beautiful books I've ever read in my entire life that still makes my students cry is Piri Thomas's Down These Mean Streets. Growing up in Spanish Harlem in the 1940s and 1950s raises all of the issues that we're talking about now: homophobia within our communities, colorism, class inequalities, labor oppression. But again, I think that that younger people now are just maybe more sophisticated, or they're just having more extended conversations within a movement context. And I really want us to conclude with, it's got to happen within a movement. I mean, it's great that I can individually go to a bookstore or go to a meeting and hear something, but working it out, you know, one-on-one and then in groups talking about, you know, colorism, privilege, talking about, you know, anti-Black racism in Latinx communities. You know, the last thing I'll mention is the exciting thing for me as a movement historian is I get invited now. And, you know, the one good thing about capitalism maybe is Zoom. And so I get invited to these conversations all over the country now. And during what we used to call Hispanic Heritage Month, I'm frequently asked by Latinx communities to talk about the issue of anti-Black racism within our communities. When I go to Black History Month talks a few months later, I'm increasingly asked to talk about anti-immigration racism and the issue of anti-Latinx racism within Black communities. And so to me, that gives me a lot of hope because it isn't just the younger people. It's that middle age and older people are beginning to reassess, like, you know, kind of where we stand vis-a-vis each other, because we're realizing those great truths that people like, you know, Jose Maratí taught back in the day, which is, I mean, we got to be in this fight together, and we can respect our important differences, but unless we can join in collective struggles, you know, we're just going to get beaten every time.
No, I hear you, and thank you for that. You know, a lot, you know, Black Lives Matter with you know, Black folks haven't started and everything has been a particularly visible and combustible issue. But, you know, I started to give talks around the region after Ferguson. And I taught for many years a race and public policy class, which was a comparative look at race. So it wasn't just about Black, it wasn't about Brown, about every Asians, white. I talked about European immigration and everything else. But then I was dubbed around and I realized, like, for instance, in LA County, because Los Angeles cops have a terrible history, but most of the people that the cops kill in LA County are Brown, are Latino, for a variety of reasons. And I think as people get together, and I think George Floyd is probably given rise to some of the dynamics that the two of you have been talking about more recently among our young people. But the Latino communities haven't really made as much noise about this, right, as the Black communities have. And I just want a couple of things about that LA thing. You know, we've been hearing a lot about Memphis, but, you know, right after New Year's, the LA cops killed three people. Two of them were Black, one of them was Latino. And the one of the Black ones was Patrice Cullors' cousin. Now, I think you all know who Patrice Cullors is. I mean, she's one of the founders of BLM hashtag after Trayvon Martin, who was a Floridian, of course. So I said, oh, they killed the wrong brother now, you know. And we haven't heard as much because Memphis happened right after that. But a lot of things happened in LA County. I want to just quickly add, one of the things that stimulated this conversation was how in LA there last fall, the Latina who was the president of the city council, you know, they caught her on tape talking not just in a bad way about Black people, but also about indigenous Guatemalans and Honduran Central American immigrants from Central America, from that part of the world, who, you know, a light-skinned, mestiza, Mexican woman in LA doesn't really have any solidarity with indigenous people from Central America either. All of this has caused a lot of tumult in Black brown communities, and which has them coming together against that woman. She got pushed out of her position heading up the city council. And I mean, I could go on and on, but I think a lot of these things that have been happening have been allowing us to see, you know, what we have in common as people of color and the need for us to work together going forward in solidarity. With that, maybe we should bring things to an end. I want to thank Ayari Aguayo and Dr. Paul Ortiz very much for giving us a little bit of your time, because I know in terms of what's going on in the state of Florida, as soon as you get off here, you're probably going to head right back out into the streets and get busy. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's an honor to be with such great comrades.
Same. Thank you so much. And for providing your expertise as well and y'all's experiences. Right now, I think the younger generation is looking for that. And we can really learn from each other and y'all's work. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.